People in the business world love to be considered innovators, but unlike a lot of them, Camille Renshaw has the awards to prove her credentials. In 2020, her accomplishments as the CEO of B+E earned her recognition by her fellow real estate executives as both CPE's Innovator of the Year and Net Lease Executive of the Year. Renshaw brought her deep background in technology to commercial real estate services at a time when many industry professionals were still skeptical of technology's value. A few years ago, she introduced an online platform that addressed the needs of an underserved investor group. In her current role, Renshaw has earned a reputation as a leader in 1031 exchange advisory services. Hi, and welcome back to Investment Matters. I'm Paul Rosta, Executive Editor at CPE. In this episode, you'll hear about Camille Renshaw's unconventional journey. She found her way to the industry as a technology entrepreneur when she sold a successful startup and was advised to invest some of the proceeds in commercial real estate assets. At first, her goal was to become a better owner, but as she relates in our conversation, she caught the bug for the real estate business herself, especially brokerage. She went on to serve in senior positions at several top brokerage firms before she went on to co-found B+E in 2017. In this episode of Investment Matters, you'll hear her thoughts on 1031 exchange trends, what's ahead for the debt markets, the role of technology in the industry, and much more. Take a listen. Camille Renshaw, welcome to Investment Matters. Very nice to be with you today.
Thanks, Paul. Great to be here.
So we are at a very helpful vantage point right now, because we're in a position to look back at the major trends of 2023 and also look ahead to 2024, of course. And I'd really like to hear your take on how 23 turned out as a whole, especially since December can be a very telling and active month. Is there anything that jumped out at you about the end of the year? Whether you want to address the market climate in general, 1031 exchanges in particular, or something else that really gives you perspective on 2023 trends?
Great question. 2023 was a strange year in that I think most of us in the brokerage business felt like it was one of our worst years as we were going through it. And what's fascinating about it is to look back, and it's kind of an average year. It might be slightly down, but it did not turn into the horrible year it felt like. It wasn't a great year either, but largely volumes in Q4 were very strong. I would say a place in the market to really shine a light is on car wash sales within net lease. Certainly a number of gas stations and other things that provide bonus depreciation tax benefits were very, very popular in Q4. But there ended up being a number of transactions that had 1031 exchanges that came to fruition towards the end of the year. Again, I wouldn't want to overstate those volumes. I don't think they were, you know, exciting by any means, but they were not nearly as abysmal as they felt like they were as we went through the year and had crickets over the summer, that kind of thing.
You know, when we talked in early December, you mentioned a couple of things that really stood out that I wanted to follow up with you on. And one of the things that you mentioned was that the 1031 market had picked up, but it was still lumpy. And lumpy was the word that you used that kind of stuck with me. And that it was going to stay lumpy until there was more certainty on interest rates. Could you elaborate on that a little bit? And has anything changed in the 6 weeks or so since we spoke most recently? You know, your biggest concerns, are you finding any more reasons for optimism now than you might have been a couple of months ago?
I don't think there are more reasons for optimism, but I do think it's playing out fairly close to that base case. When I said lumpy, it really just meant that there are going to be moments when a number of transactions are going to occur, you know, for the relinquished properties. I think that we had talked a little bit about multifamily and starting to see fits and starts within the multifamily segment, some transactions taking place there that throw off 1031 exchanges. Often families that own multifamily will move into net lease with those 1031 exchanges. And it just is happening again in fits and starts. There were a number of transactions that occurred in, or were originated, I should say, started in September, October, and came to a conclusion towards the end of the year. A lot of those immediately flipped into another closing within the net lease world. If someone had already sourced that property in the fall, a number of families wait until the closing occurs before they go out and source more property. And I would say right now we're seeing, I would say we're sitting here January 17th on maybe the 12th, we began to experience an influx of contracts, offers, that kind of thing for replacement property. And we'll really be seeing those closings come to fruition towards the end of the quarter.
Something else that you mentioned before that really stuck with me was that, in effect, when things go badly in multifamily, we put our seatbelts on. So, what could you tell our audience a little bit more about what you had in mind there, and maybe even give a little context about that observation?
I think probably just to point to the immediate case, there certainly were many apartment complexes or multifamily properties that closed at the end of the year, but volumes aren't historically great. They're not very strong. So there will be a limited number of 1031 exchanges that have that domino effect into our space. Certainly a number of multifamily owners just want to own multifamily and do exchanges into their next multifamily project. And certainly they could buy any property type, self-storage, what have you. But there is an overwhelming trend that when families that have generational wealth own apartment complexes and want to sell and move the wealth to the next generation, often the next generation not only doesn't know where the boiler is, they may not know what a boiler is at all, you know. And so net lease helps with that generational problem. You know, that just each generation has their own specialization, their own areas of interest. And often the generation that made all the money with scrappy manufacturing property investments in New York City or, you know, multifamily in California, something like that, they want to pass the money on to the next generation, but they don't have the luxury of passing all the same drivers and skills on to the next generation or two. So net lease really protects that wealth and allows them to still have very stabilized returns, but that new generation or younger generation doesn't have to work the real estate in the same manner.
Well, everyone is focusing on the new year by now, and considering the fluid state of the economy and the real estate capital markets, other issues as well, what are your overall expectations for, let's say, the first quarter or even the first half, if you feel comfortable looking quite that far ahead and in the middle of all these moving parts?
Normally we're at these conferences, right? Or we're on various panels and we're asked to project a year from now or even 18 months from now. And it's funny, no one's asking me to project that far right now. None of us know. I wish we did. I would say what's been interesting that we haven't spoken to yet is this vacillation in terms of where the Fed rate is and the signal that we got in December that there are going to be multiple cuts to the Fed rate. To the tune of something like 75 bips in 2024. While that doesn't sound historically like a lot, given recent trends, everybody's very excited about it. We saw the stock market really overcorrect for it, and then as you know, sort of push back again. There probably will be several ups and downs, fits and starts as we get various signals out of the Fed. But I do think the overall belief is that the Fed rate will lower. There's no way that the United States can afford its deficit at this level. So we've got to have, at some point in time, a pullback. And I would say we're probably going to pull back, certainly into the fours, probably into the threes at some point. I don't think it's in the next quarter that you asked about, but that anticipation is there. And even if we don't even get the full 75 bips, and God bless if we got more than that, the anticipation is it's not going to get worse. So the conversations we're having right now with principals are, let's play it where it lies. This is the field right now. We can wait for it to get better. Probably not going to see that full 75 bips until the fall. So, for example, an owner that I spoke with today has a mortgage ballooning in August. They want to sell before that mortgage balloons, or they need to refinance and take that risk. They're not going to take that risk. They're going to go ahead and sell this spring. They know that April will likely be a very strong month. Will it be historically the strongest month ever? No, but they will be able to achieve their long-term goals by going ahead and playing in the current market. And again, the market's not going to be worse when they go to do their 1031 exchange. I think that sets the context for where we're headed in the coming year. It could get much better, and then I think a deal activity will just begin to flow. But I think largely everyone expects the market to stay fairly stable, and you've got to go ahead and execute your family's long-term plans. Is someone getting married? Is someone retiring from the business? Whatever is happening, those family offices have to make decisions. Now, I should speak to family offices are not the only player in the room, right? We have institutions and very small investors also playing into this. But the family offices are the real driver. They, especially in net lease, they are the group that is spending the most. They are the group that pays the highest price, that sort of thing. So they're really fascinating to watch.
And just to follow up on that, is there anything that you see changing in what your family office clients are looking for right now, and what's really changing in their strategy?
The discussions that we're having are often, you can go out and achieve a slightly better cap rate right now than you could certainly 2, 3 years ago. Your debt is not going to be as accretive. So, can you get debt that enables you to achieve that slightly higher cap rate and then refinance in 2, 3 years? And to have a gain as a result. That's really the conversation that they're having. Now, be clear, most family offices are not speculative added value buyers. So they're excited if this achieves an extra, 50, 100 basis points for them. That would be a huge home run. They're generally looking for low risk investments to make. So they're trying to choose their spots. And also, just in terms of the actual tenants, to see where is their growth. We've seen tremendous growth in car wash, as I mentioned in Q4. That's going to begin to sunset as the bonus depreciation law expires. What's the next segment in net lease to be truly excited about? And there is some conversation around early learning. There's conversation sustained, I would say, conversation around grocery. There are various segments that families are excited about and feel like you can still have a real win in.
Well, certainly interest rates have been the talk of the industry for a long time now, but are there any other economic indicators that you think investors should at least keep in mind as they plan their strategy, whether it's the inflation, the job market, or probably other issues as well? Or is it really it, it Are interest rates really the biggest game in town?
I do think that debt is the biggest game in town. I don't think that interest rates are the only big game. I would definitely say it remains a hot topic. One of the components of mortgage debt that I've been discussing in call after call with potential sellers is the availability of non-recourse debt versus recourse. I feel like this is an under-discussed topic because if you have an asset that it especially is, $10 or $15 million in size or larger, but even if it's 4 or 5 million in size, those buyers really will not want to take recourse on that debt. Just the sophistication and experience of that buyer profile won't want to, and then the size compounds it. There has not been great availability of non-recourse debt at any interest rate. There has been some, but there hasn't been a great deal available. And that has really clamped down on the buyer pool in a way, again, that I feel is under-discussed. I will say here in January, we are getting way more quotes on non-recourse debt. They often have various unique carve-outs, that it is subject to a land appraisal of a certain rate, or it springs with, certain conditions. But there is more availability. There is more loosening there. And that's really the name of the game, is let's get the buyer pool to be larger. And the more demand we have, then the easier it is to flush out supply. We certainly have some supply that is built up in the market.
In this early part of the year, do you see signs of stepped up activity or interest from any particular group of investors, whether it is the family offices, of course, high net worth individuals, REITs, private funds, any shifts that you're seeing there?
I think there's going to be more loosening with the REITs and publicly traded companies. And some of that is just going to come as they get more liquidity from the markets. Currently, where we're seeing most of the activity, though, is from private funds and family offices. That's largely where the activity is. I also shouldn't overlook the developers who, there are a number of developers that have very healthy pipelines, and they've been waiting on supply chain concerns, labor, name their laundry list of things that have sort of gone wrong in their segment to shift so that they can flush out some of their property pipeline. A lot of that product is on the market, and I think there's pretty compelling pricing for that because those developers want to flush it out and kind of start fresh. They've got great demand on the leasing side. I would say when we were at ICSC in December, that was the hot topic, right? Leasing, leasing, leasing. Everybody who's in leasing is doing well. There's tremendous demand from the tenants. And as a part of that as well, we have a number of PE firms or just corporates that are looking to do sale leasebacks. That's really, again, tenant motivation, tenant looking for capital in order to grow, expand, to execute their business plans. There's a fair amount of activity in that segment as well.
But I mean, just given the some of the challenges, let's say, in the capital markets and investment that we've seen, does this seem like an opportune time for sale leasebacks
It
compared
does.
to last year, or?
It does feel like an opportune time. If you're trying to execute a business plan as a tenant, you can't wait for the Fed rate to shift in 2 or 3 years, right? You could really miss market opportunity that is a much greater exponential than whatever you might lose on the real estate due to, slightly higher cap rates. So it's a great time for that. I would also say, as I'm pointing to difficulty to achieve debt within the real estate market and that we're excited about non-recourse starting to come back, there are similar hurdles for corporate debt. And there certainly has been just a lack of debt available, especially at any higher multiple on the corporate side. So a great way to monetize the assets that you have so you can execute on a plan to sale leaseback. So this is historically a pretty strong time for that. As far as the buyers for that, I don't think there's ever a bad time to buy a sale leaseback. There's always it's always good to have a sale leaseback if it's quality tenant, quality real estate. That's a great, great way to build a portfolio.
Neil, I'd like to talk a little bit about your personal journey in this business, since you did find your way to commercial real estate through a fairly uncommon path, I think it's fair to say. And as I understand it, you initially came to the industry as an owner. So could you tell our audience a little bit about how that happened? For example, one of the companies that of the many that you have founded was Disco Technologies, which you sold to American Financial Services about 20 years ago, I think. So how did Disco begin your evolution into commercial real estate investment, and what's kind of the backstory there?
As a young person in my teens, I started coding and was involved with various tech startups. In my 20s, I was fortunate enough to sell a couple of them, including Disco. That's the one most folks know about. At that moment in time, my family, my father and grandfather really stepped in and said, "Hey, you may not make this level of capital ever again. You should invest it safely." I from there invested in a number of things on the real estate side, but I did buy a portfolio of single tenant net lease properties. I have since then, over those 20 years, sold through everything that I purchased except a number of those single tenant assets. It's just such a durable category. I would say I began to learn a lot through that purchasing process about how commercial real estate works. I had the good fortune to work alongside Pat Duffy, one of the greats on the retail side. He was president of Colliers in Florida at that time. He taught me a ton about how net lease works and what motivates buyers and sellers, introduced me to a number of folks across the industry. Again, really what I had in mind was being an owner, trying to be a better owner. And what happened instead is I caught the bug. I just really enjoyed the brokerage business. I was constantly learning, which I think is my ultimate driver, is am I, stimulated to just constantly be learning? And you have that in commercial real estate. All the market cycles have certain things in common, but they are all very, very different. And there's just such a spectrum of assets that you can choose to learn things about. I really started as an industrial and medical broker. And then, as I said, Pat taught me tons about net lease within those segments, but certainly within retail as well. From there, I went on to joined the Stan Johnson Company, founding their New York City office. That's really where I came to understand net lease real estate in that world in a, global sense, or certainly on a national level. That was such a gift to work at that company. Again, just wonderful leadership and great peers there to work alongside. That's really where I met my partner, Scott Skurich, and that's where I met a number of the founding members of B plus E. We began building up the New York City office and doing a number of noteworthy transactions, portfolios, and whatnot. And really across the spectrum, office, industrial, medical, retail. And I grew to have a pretty sizable team there.
And could you also tell us a little bit about your involvement with 10X, which, as I understand it, was is another milestone for you, another phase and major phase in your career.
Yeah, I was excited to join 10X because one of the problems that I had as a young real estate broker, entrepreneur, is I tended not to tell my tech background. It just was very confusing for folks. If you can go back to that time period, no one thought technology should have anything to do with commercial real estate. So if I said that, I immediately diluted my brand and diluted any of my industry knowledge or perception of that knowledge. So I kind of kept it to myself. When I went to 10X and brought that team from SJC with me, I had the opportunity, one, to really bring my resume together, I would say, bring that background together and make it kind of make sense holistically. But also had the opportunity to have Scott and others learn more about CRE tech. It was a really wonderful experience for everybody involved. We had the great opportunity to work on several new products at 10X, just learned tons about what happens on the auction side of the business. But I would say the realization that we had while we were there is that there really were no tech products or CRE tech products at that time that helped 1031 exchangers or helped this family office client that I keep talking about maximize their tax events, and sort of maximize proceeds on very, very stabilized assets. Again, if you've got an asset that has great vacancy or is destabilized in any way or added value, 10X continues to be great, great execution for that. But it's not the best execution if you have a 20-year sale leaseback or something that is at its peak value moment. So we began thinking, what could we do with that?
So in 2017, I believe you and Scott launched BE Plus E. And for the benefit of anyone in our audience who doesn't know what the initials stand for, could I ask you how you came up with the name? I mean, it's not Camille and Scott's company. Your initials aren't in there. It's no CRE or anything. What does that stand for, and why did you come up with it again?
Well, when we formed the company, we really made a bet on human plus tech. That's the bet. We had joined 10X after they had made a colossal mistake, from which they've now recovered, but was very difficult for them, in which they tried to disintermediate the broker in commercial real estate, really in residential real estate as well, but just to get rid of the broker. And in a sense, try and drive transactions through technology alone. And it was a really, the reason I got hired, or one of the reasons I got hired at 10X, was to try and help fix that. And hiring a brokerage team helped with their image and helped with their, sort of brand forward. We knew you can't get rid of the guy that has all the relationships. That's just going to sink the ship. You can't do that. That does not work. But we also knew, having been at SJC, which is such a strong firm, or was a strong firm, it's now Northmark. But SJC was such a strong firm, but really had no technology, no proprietary technology, I should say. And it was a real weak point at SJC. We realized neither one quite worked for our vision for the future. So B plus E stands for brokers plus engineers, meaning great brokers need great tech engineers. And it's, again, really a bet on human plus tech in the future. You've got to have both, not one or the other, in order to succeed in commercial real estate.
One major step that you and Scott took 4 years ago now was that you introduced the first ever online platform for 1031 exchanges. And that was at ICSC's New York City event in December 2019. Is that correct? And what was the, when you look back now with the hindsight of 4 years, what was the impact of introducing that platform?
So the platform's called 1031 Trade, and it works really well for family offices that are frustrated by kind of the confusion of the 45-day naming period, sourcing property nationally. It calls together the whole market for them in a very private, confidential platform experience, so that you and your brother or your wife or whoever it is can have a conjoined experience looking through the market together, underwrite tenants, underwrite leases, just scour the market for whatever is of the greatest value and interest to your family at that time. It was really transformative because before that, buyers would keep these enormous Excel spreadsheets, It was very confusing because as soon as you kind of narrowed down 20 properties to the three you wanted to name and you called them back, there were already other LOIs on them and they were gone. And so then you try and frantically start over and you would be calling places. None of those properties would be available again. So we realized it was important to keep a real-time data set as the backbone of 1031 trade. We set that up, say on a given day, it's about 4,000 properties that are live. It fluctuates as properties come in and out. But that was a really transformative experience for both the broker and the client.
Does seem like the last decade or so that the industry's embrace of technology has evolved quite a bit. We see a lot more of it out there in general, but given both your technology background, your finance background, and commercial real estate background, of course, how would you sum up the industry's use of technology at this point? How much progress has there been, and how much more does there need to be?
It will have its own gravity. I mean, it'll sort of find its own way, I think, but it's still highly underutilized. We could certainly be using it more. The reason why it's a bit sluggish in commercial real estate versus even residential real estate is the sheer dollars involved. No one wants to entrust millions of dollars to a system. And certainly, if it's an institutional player, they don't want to entrust tens or hundreds of millions to a tech system. They need someone to help them when there's judgment involved. Most of what we do in commercial real estate is not a binary, right? It's not absolutely you should own this, absolutely don't own this. Most of our decisions are this property or this segment even interests me, but I'm not 100% sure what all the risks and hurdles are today. You really need a human to help vet that. I'm sure AI will come along and be able to help more with that in years to come, but it is way off in terms of providing any real judgment because that judgment is based usually on, any of the gray hair that I have, right? Came from other market cycles. And this market cycle, as I said earlier, is not really like any other market cycle, but there are certain things, same, but different, that I can extrapolate and then play forward with. I think that commercial real estate does utilize tech a fair amount, but I think it's still sort of in property management or asset management and search engines. We've gotten to where Crexie and CoStar and LoopNet and other platforms can help us source property, but it doesn't really help us underwrite it. It doesn't really help with that judgment piece. There's not a lot that's going to top the human experience in terms of incorporating people. But I would say that for anyone listening to this that has ever had the need for a surgeon or a great physician, you want to go to a doctor that has the best in class technology. You want to go to a brand name, you want to be at the Cleveland Clinic or Moffitt or somewhere, Cedars-Sinai. You want to be at a great hospital. You want great physicians with great technology. And also, if you've ever had the experience of sitting there, you don't want to hear anything about it. It's a really complicated perspective when you're under stress and you're trying to make high stakes decisions. So you do want to choose brokers that have great technology at their fingertips, very much like a best-in-class physician. But I think there also is some understanding that those clients also don't need to go get a graduate degree in coding in order to understand what the AI is doing. They just want to make the best decision about a Walgreens portfolio. And so it is interesting how it's advancing, but I think it's advancing towards the brokers and advisors that have a lot of technology at their fingertips and know how to manipulate it the best on behalf of their clients.
So now we come to one of my favorite parts of every Investment Matters episode, which is CEOs off the clock. Now, we can't work 24/7, even though it seems like we try sometimes. So I always like to ask executives if there's anything that they like to do when they're not on the clock. Is there anything in particular that you enjoy doing that when you do have an opportunity to recharge the batteries?
I love to go backpacking and hiking. I spend a lot of my life backpacking and hiking in the great outdoors. I would say I've done that since I was a kid, but I certainly have hiked not all of, but the majority of the Appalachian Trail, the Pacific Coast Trail. I've done lots of hiking in the Alps, the Rockies, various places. I love it. And honestly, I'm happy to just go walk across the Williamsburg Bridge here in New York City too. I love being in the great outdoors and going on long hikes.
So it sounds like that whether it's the mountains or the forests or even a great bridge like the Williamsburg, that it's all good.
It is, and I have a Labrador retriever who is here at my feet actually that loves to go on all those hikes and trips with me. He's happy if we're hiking to work or if we're hiking to the next shelter along the Appalachian Trail.
Hard to imagine a better traveling companion than a lab, right?
He is the best,
That
yes.
that's great. That's great. Well, Camille, it's been a real pleasure having you here on Investment Matters. Appreciate your time. Very good of you to walk us through some of your views on the market, as well as your personal journey in the commercial real estate. So nice to have you, and I'm sure our audience is going to appreciate your insights as well.
Thank you, Paul. It's been a great conversation.
That was my conversation with Camille Renshaw, the co-founder and CEO of B Plus E. Please join me next time for another conversation with a leading commercial real estate investment executive. You can find archived episodes of Investment Matters and more CPE podcasts on Apple Podcasts and on our website, commercialsearch.com. Before you go, let me take a moment to tell you about an exciting opportunity. The CPE Executive Council is a group of industry leaders who exchange ideas about trending real estate issues. Highlights of their discussions are posted on our website and featured in our newsletters. If you're interested in joining the council, please contact CPE's Editor-in-Chief, Jessica Feuer, at jessica.feuer, that's Feuer, at cpe-mhn.com. Until next time, thanks for listening and be well.